From the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, America's premier medical research agency, this is Pinpoint on Women's Health with Dr. Vivian Pinn, Director of the Office of Research on Women's Health. Now, here's Dr. Pinn.
Welcome to another episode of Pinpoint on Women's Health. Each month on this podcast, we take a look at some of the latest developments in the areas of women's health and the medical research that affects our lives. For our podcast today, I'm so happy to welcome Dr. Linda Brubaker, who is Assistant Dean for Clinical and Translational Research, Professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology and Urology, as well as Director of the Division of Female Pelvic Medicine and Reconstructive Surgery at Loyola University Medical Center in Maywood, Illinois. She will be discussing with us the topic of pelvic floor disorders. But first, some hot flashes from the world of women's health research, coming up in just 60 seconds when we continue with Pinpoint on Women's Health.
Attention shoppers, if anyone is missing a rather plump set of love handles, please come to the customer service counter and claim them. The ample love handles were lost in the produce department where their former owner had purchased fruits and veggies to munch on during the big game. Thank you and have a good day.
Small step number 81, snack on fruits and veggies. It's just one of the many small steps you can take to get healthy. Learn more at www.smallstep.gov.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Pinpoint on Women's Health. As promised, it's again time to take a look at just a few of the hot flashes in the news regarding women's health research. Well, there were many things to choose from to talk to you about in this podcast, but I want to just mention three briefly. First, there is good news coming out of Philadelphia's Fox Chase Cancer Center for breast cancer survivors. In a report from Fox Chase, it was reported that women who've had a lumpectomy and radiation for their breast cancer overall have a quality of life several years after treatment that's on par with most American women. That's very exciting because so many women who have breast cancer and face surgery or radiation for breast cancer are concerned about the quality of life, and we know in the past we may not have had the outcomes that we have today following research and improved techniques and improved ways of managing breast cancer. These results were presented at the American Society for Therapeutic Radiology and Oncology at their annual meeting, and we are very excited and pleased to hear that good news. Second, I want to bring to your attention a report from physical therapists. And at a recent meeting of the American Physical Therapy Association, it was reported that some special exercises can help women who engage in physical exercise or in sports to be able to prevent or lessen the possibility of having ACL tears. Well, what are ACL tears? We know that anterior cruciate ligament injuries, which are called ACL injuries or ACL tears, are usually far more frequent, in fact, about four times more frequent in women than they are in men, even during the same type of sports participation. And it is one of the most common injuries we see in female athletes or as women are increasing in their participation in physical fitness activities as a result of strenuous or other exercises. The American Physical Therapy Association is suggesting that there are some exercises that women can engage in that can help to lessen the possibility or lessen the risk of developing these injuries. For more information about these exercises, I refer you to their website, which is www.apta.org/consumer. Good luck. And the final bit of news I want to bring is something really just to have you keep in mind and discuss with your obstetrician if you are pregnant and considering whether or not to have natural birth or C-sections. There was a recent report pointing out that a C-section rate of about 5 to 10% is usually that is thought to be best for mothers and babies. But recently, over 31% of births in the United States are now by C-section. It is best if you're anticipating birth to discuss the possibilities, because there are times, as we know, when C-sections are important or are the desired mode of delivery, and other times when it may be questioned whether or not there are more C-sections being done than are absolutely necessary for the health of the newborn or the mother. So I bring to you this new data that was just released and encourage you to discuss these findings and how your mode of delivery will be with your obstetrician, because depending upon your own situation, in an individual basis, can the best decision be made. And with that, there's much more going on in the field of women's health research, and we will have more updates in the next podcast. But coming up next, we will have an opportunity to visit with Dr. Brubaker and discuss pelvic floor disorders. We'll be right back with more Pinpoint on Women's Health. Welcome back to Pinpoint on Women's Health. Our guest today, Dr. Linda Brubaker, has come to the NIH to help with this podcast and bring you information about pelvic floor disorders from the Chicago area. She is Assistant Dean for Clinical and Translational Research, as well as Professor in the Department of OBGYN and Urology, as well as Director of the Division of Female Pelvic Medicine and Reconstructive Surgery, all at Loyola University Medical Center outside of Chicago. So she is very well qualified to talk with us about this topic. In addition, and perhaps as important, is that she is also one of the original investigators funded as part of the NIH-supported Pelvic Floor Disorders Network. And she is therefore going to talk to us about pelvic floor disorders, why it's important for us to know about it, and what we can anticipate in terms of ongoing and expected research. So, Dr. Brubaker, welcome.
Well, thank you. It's very much an honor to be here, and I very much want to thank you on behalf of all the patients who suffer with pelvic floor disorders for your continued support of important research in this area. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, and thank you for giving your attention and dedicating your research efforts to this as one of the many issues I know you addressed in your practice and in your research. So why don't we begin by having you explain, what are pelvic floor disorders? Why is it important that we know about them?
That's a question our patients ask. What exactly is a pelvic floor disorder? And we simply explain it by saying that pelvic floor disorders are a group of disorders that affect the pelvis, and typically we're talking about women. And the most common is urinary incontinence in all the forms, where you may involuntarily leak urine when you don't want to. Pelvic organ prolapse, where part of the vagina or reproductive tract, such as the uterus, begins to prolapse too low in the vagina or actually outside the body. And also disorders of bowel control called fecal incontinence, where you can lose bowel control and leak bowel movement when you don't want to.
How common are pelvic floor disorders? Is it something only one or two women here and there may experience, or is it something that's fairly common, and is it age affected?
These pelvic floor disorders are amazingly common in American women. We have a new publication this month in the medical journal called JAMA, and we know that on average, one out of four American women is affected with at least one of these three disorders that I just mentioned, and it does become more common as women age.
Well, tell us some of the specifics about pelvic floor disorders. What about, for example, when you have uterine prolapse? What, for example, if you have urinary incontinence? What do we know about the causes, or should I say, the contributors to this? What is a pelvic floor disorder? What do we really mean? What has happened? We know what's happened, but why does it happen? And what are we learning about them?
Well, although we need much more research in how these things happen, we are clear that for many women, the act of having a child increases their risk of having many kinds of these pelvic floor disorders, particularly urinary incontinence, called stress incontinence, where you leak urine with a cough, a laugh, a sneeze, or a physical activity. But we also know from our recent study that 1 out of 8 women who never had a child may have a pelvic floor disorder. So it's not completely protective. We know that connective tissues are involved and the health of nerves and muscles are involved, and different women may have different combinations of causes for their pelvic floor disorders, and that's why it's important that we continue our work to find out the best individualized treatment for each woman.
Well, you know, it's something that we don't hear women talk about a lot, and at a recent seminar at the NIH on urinary tract, Dr. Jeanette Brown from the University of California, San Francisco, said she wanted to make urinary incontinence a topic of cocktail chatter. And I think by that she meant that she wants to bring it out of the closet, sort of the way we brought menopause out of the closet so women will talk about it. So let me ask you, as a physician who treats and who diagnoses and who helps women with pelvic floor disorders that may manifest in any of the conditions you've already described, do we have a problem with women owning up or admitting to these issues, and how might that affect our health and our quality of life?
We very much have a problem. There is a sisterhood of silence about pelvic floor disorders. Women suffer in silence. They think that they're the only people who have the problem, and they may hide this secret for many, many years, even from an intimate partner of many decades. And this really impacts the quality of their life, the quality of their recreational life, their professional lives, their intimate lives. And we need to find ways to help break the sisterhood of silence. Now, we have some real challenges with that because, quote, wetting your pants, unquote, is one of the most common jokes for comedians in the health professions. If you think of all the health-related jokes that you hear on late-night TV, urinary incontinence is often listed there. And that simply has to stop because it's not a laughing matter. It's a devastating condition for many affected patients.
Well, while we try to figure out how we can get that point across, let me ask you to explain to our audience that if you happen to have uterine prolapse, or if you're dealing with urinary incontinence or stress incontinence, and you might just explain what stress incontinence is, or even fecal incontinence, why is it important to talk to your physician about it, and what do we know that we can do to help a woman who has any of these forms of pelvic floor disorders?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the first thing, let's talk about how we think about stress incontinence. An easy way to imagine things is imagine that your bladder is a birthday party balloon. You've got the balloon and then the little knot and then the little spigot. Think of the balloon as the bladder and the knot as an important muscle called the urinary sphincter. In stress incontinence, that knot is not doing its job. And that can happen for several reasons. The nerves and muscles may not be healthy, or it may be put out of position and it can't work well. And those are things that can be treated. So women who begin to feel these problems, if they bring it to the attention of their healthcare provider, we can do simple things while the condition is fairly mild that are easy to go through. They don't take a lot of time out of a woman's personal and professional life, and they can give good symptom control. Just like anything else, our house, our car, if we wait till it's badly broken, it takes much more to fix things properly. So we encourage people to be in contact with healthcare professionals once they begin to experience bother.
For women whose symptomatology has advanced, meaning they've got more severe forms of incontinence, might there have to be surgery, and if so, what type of surgery? Or am I out of line here by even thinking about surgery for these conditions?
No, that's actually an important area because many people don't raise the issue of pelvic floor disorders because they're afraid of surgery. And while surgery is certainly a possibility for some women with pelvic floor disorders, many women can be treated and have good improvement of their symptoms without going through surgery. And I'm happy to report that we've really made some significant advances in certain forms of surgery, making it easier for people to go through so that it doesn't take as much time out of their personal professional lives, and we can try to reduce the complications.
Well, what kind of surgery would you do?
Well, the kinds of surgery we do really should be tailored to the individual woman, her goals for treatment, and what other pelvic floor disorders. This is something we haven't talked that much about. We've alluded to it, but a patient may have more than one pelvic disorder. They can have one, two, or all three of these conditions at the same time. And some of them respond better to surgery than others, but even with surgery just for incontinence or prolapse, we still can offer treatment side by side with the surgery to make sure that the whole pelvis is restored.
Describe what some of these behavioral therapies might be.
Well, some of the important behavioral therapies are to learn to be, to help your bladder by being what I call a sipper, not a guzzler. We've learned over time to not eat very, very big meals. We're trying to work on portion size in America. And the same thing goes for our solid food. Should go for our liquid food. So rather than drinking a 32-ounce Slurpee of something and guzzling it down, and then having all that fluid show up in your bladder suddenly, that can overwhelm a bladder that's having a little difficulty. So being a sipper, taking a small amount of fluid regularly, helps your bladder handle that fluid load and helps your bladder be more friendly to you without intrusive interruptions of having to rush to the washroom and feeling like you'll lose urine on the way.
Well, that's an important concept. We've had a number of podcasts dealing with being overweight, with obesity, dealing with diabetes, and we've talked a lot about portion distortion and eating in moderation and watching the diet. So perhaps that's an important point to drive home, which is maybe, well, not maybe, certainly from what you said, we need to think about not only eating in moderation, but drinking, and I don't mean alcohol here, I mean in terms of intake of fluids, in moderation. I like that. Repeat that again, that advice about sipping.
So I tell my patients to be sippers, not guzzlers. Think of the amount of fluid coming into your mouth as showing up in your bladder, and you want a small amount coming from time to time, not a large amount coming suddenly. So adjust how you take your fluids, and I know most women are already aware that caffeinated beverages, including sodas and diet sodas and coffee, can really kind of irritate the bladder and make you feel like you have to go more often. So adjusting the type of fluid and being a sipper, not a guzzler, is a simple way to begin to get on top of those symptoms.
That's probably a very important and succinct point to take away from this discussion about what women themselves can do in addition to what they may look to their physicians and healthcare providers to do to help them. Dr. Brubaker, are there some things that women might be doing to cope with their condition that may be helpful or that may not be helpful that our audience should hear about?
Yes, there are. Women are very smart people, so they try to figure out all different ways to keep their symptoms at a minimum. And some of these are helpful, and some of them actually may seem to make things better, but they actually can make things worse. Patients often do several behaviors like what we call bathroom mapping, where they go to the bathroom very often, they know where every bathroom is, and they go before they leave, and they go the first thing when they get there, and they're going so often that they lose the normal signaling of the control of their bladder. They're not the boss anymore, their bladder's the boss. And so that's a behavior that we can begin to modulate so that they get their life back. They're not being ruled by the bladder. Another behavior that we try to stop is where people simply don't drink, because that's not healthy for their heart or their skin, the rest of their body. So just not drinking isn't a healthy thing. And we all have patients who carry around a big bottle of water. And anyone who's carrying a big bottle of water, I worry about, because if they're actually drinking that much water, it's probably too much. But some of them just carry it, and they never drink it, so that they have an excuse for going to the bathroom very often. And so those are things that we can help with. And these adaptive behaviors that patients are learning to do, that very smart women are doing, you should touch base with your doctor, because some of them can be improved so that you don't have to have your bladder ruining your life.
What do you advise your patients who have suffered an embarrassing instance because of either urinary incontinence, meaning leaking urine or wetting their pants, or even more so, an episode of fecal incontinence, so they don't become hermits or be afraid to go out or to face public? Obviously, they'll need some medical approach, but how do you advise them to handle it psychologically?
Yeah, it's an important question, because there's certain clothing that people who are worried about leakage wear. It impacts their clothing. They don't want to wear light-colored clothes or lightweight fabrics. So most women learn to wear some type of protective pad that would be sufficient to control an episode. But patients can recall very vividly that episode that was so deeply embarrassing to them. And it's an emotional scar that we have to talk about and help them get over. And that comes with giving them a sense of confidence and a sense of well-being and a restored body image, that they're beautiful women, they're strong women, and we just got to get their pelvis to keep up with them.
Is it more difficult helping to resolve the issues, especially around perhaps modulating bladder control over controlling your bladder in women who are older or elderly?
There's two sides to that. There are challenges with women who face more impact as they age, but they also seem to be more willing to adjust their lives a little bit, and they have more realistic expectations about what they want to achieve. So I really enjoy taking care of patients who are a little bit older. There's a lot that we can do together as a team.
And help improve those maturing years.
And really make those golden years golden.
Well, you're part of the Pelvic Floor Disorders Network, which NIH is funding. You want to tell us a little bit about that network and what you're doing as part of that network?
Well, we're working on behalf of the taxpayers, using their money to help conduct medical research focused on the pelvic floor disorders in women. So we are doing a variety of studies looking at ways of preventing problems, of treating problems, of diagnosing problems, and advancing the science of pelvic floor disorders. Together, there's about 7 clinical centers that are supported by a data center, and we design and conduct the studies. And we've been very, very blessed with good support and been able to make some significant contributions that have changed the way we take care of women with pelvic floor disorders.
Can you tell us where those centers are located?
Yes, we have, in addition to our center at Loyola, we have a center at the University of Iowa, at Duke University, at Cleveland Clinic, at University of Texas Southwest, at University of California San Diego, and at University of Alabama Birmingham.
So for our listeners, if you're in one of those areas and you are dealing with some form of pelvic floor disorder, or if you have family or friends in those areas, you know that you can suggest that they contact the directors of these centers, because you know that you've got experienced investigators as well as clinicians that are taking a particular look at these issues in those centers. That's not to say that other centers don't have expertise, but these are the ones that are part of the currently funded Pelvic Floor Disorders Network. So I'm going to ask Dr. Brubaker to tell us and to inform our listeners, what are we learning from research, and what hope does research seem to be bringing, or what can we look forward to if we happen to be one of those suffering from any of the symptoms of pelvic floor disorders?
Well, first of all, I would welcome your listeners to visit our website at pfdn.org. And that's we have a public website that helps explain some of the conditions we've talked about today, and also explain some of the studies and some of the results of the studies that have been published in language that's a little easier to read than the doctor stuff in the journals. So I encourage your audience to come and visit our website.
Tell us the website again.
pfdn.org, Pelvic Floor Disorders Network. I think if they also just type in Pelvic Floor Disorders Network, they'll get taken there. So I hope that that's a useful resource for your audience.
And tell us about some of the other research that may be going on. What are we learning from research that really is sort of the message of hope or demonstrates why we are funding research related to pelvic floor disorders?
Well, we are very, very fortunate in the Pelvic Floor Disorders Network. We've been able to design and finish some studies that have shown us some very, very important results. One of the first studies we did was the first study to show that while we're doing surgery on a woman for prolapse, this condition where the uterus or another portion of the vagina is too low, we are able to prevent new symptoms after the surgery by adding several stitches around the bladder area. And that study actually has changed the way that many people provide care about for their patients. And we're continuing to do that study in a different group of women to extend and see if we can minimize these symptoms for women after surgery and as they get older. We also have new treatment studies, including a study of botulinum toxin, commonly called Botox, which helps control the bladder when nothing else has seemed to help. And that seems to be a very promising therapy, and we're going to begin doing some other studies and comparing that to some more traditional treatments, including medication.
I'm going to ask you to say a little bit more about the Botox treatment. I'm sure that many in our audience have heard about Botox because we hear about it all the time in TV about those who may be having Botox treatments for their facial lines. But here we have another potential use for Botox. So how far along are we on learning about its possible effects and translating that into clinical use? Have we gotten there yet? And what does it actually do when you use it?
Well, it's a very interesting molecule. The material, Botox, is not approved for marketing for bladder control indications. So we use it only in a research setting at this time. And so what we do with it, though, in our first study, we found that people who had taken the traditional medications and tried the traditional therapies and still were really suffering with their symptoms, we injected it into their bladder in the office through a cystoscope, and that's something that's not uncommon. And the patients, about 60% of them, felt that that therapy gave them adequate control of their bladder symptoms. So we saw a very good response. Now, there's a lot still to learn about using this type of therapy. We need to learn the right dose. We need to learn how often we should give it. And so some of those therapies are being designed, some of those trials are being designed right now. But this is beginning to roll into the clinical therapy area actually quite quickly. It appears to have a strong effect.
Well, that's very interesting. And, of course, as you pointed out, it's what's called an off-label use of the drug. It's being used in research, so our listeners should not rush off to their dermatologist and ask for bladder injections to deal with their incontinence. I'm joking, of course. However, very serious topic, but obviously some very promising research points out to me sort of an example of how research can be very exciting, because sometimes we learn uses of medications and drugs or therapies that are used for something far different that we learn may be very helpful in situations we might never have thought of. And I'm sure there's a good physiologic response that could be used to explain the potential here. But keep in mind that this is still experimental, but very exciting. Well, I want to ask you, I've asked you some questions and sort of gone through some of the high points of pelvic floor disorders, but I'm going to ask you if you would at this time, Dr. Brubaker, summarize again for us what pelvic floor disorders are and tell us what things you would want our listening audience to know that I haven't given you an opportunity to discuss.
I think the first important thing that I would like to do is I'd like to speak to the women who are affected, either them or their family or their friends, and let them know they're not alone. So don't suffer in silence. We know from recent studies in American women that about 1 out of 10 women, 1 out of 10, between 20 and 40, have at least one of these problems, and it goes as high as half of the women over 80. So on average, in America, 1 out of 4 women have pelvic floor disorder. of urinary incontinence, fecal incontinence, or pelvic organ prolapse. So you're not alone, don't suffer in silence, and there's treatment that doesn't necessarily require surgery. So I want to convey hope. I want to convey the robustness of the data that's being developed. It's really very exciting time in research. For us, it's a day without data is a day without sunshine. There's so much happening right now. We really are going to make some major breakthroughs with the continued support that we've had.
I want to thank you for the excitement you bring about not only what research can do in helping us learn more about issues and women's health conditions that women and their physicians may not have answers for now, but that hopefully we'll have in the future through research and study, but also the promise of hope for, obviously, the millions of women, young and old, who may be suffering from these pelvic prolapse conditions. It may not be a cause of death, but it certainly can be a cause of poor quality of life and affect what we do, how we do it, and when we do it. So I want to thank Dr. Brubaker for an excellent discussion. And coming up next, a few final thoughts for this month when Pinpoint on Women's Health continues.
I just didn't think I could be having a heart attack.
Heart disease is the number one killer of women. It can lead to heart attack, disability, and death.
I was overweight and had high cholesterol, but I thought I was healthy. I'd had diabetes about 4 years, but I had no idea that it was a risk factor.
Talk to your doctor about your risk. Take action today to lower it.
Most of my friends do not think it can happen to them.
Learn the heart truth. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, National Institutes of Health, National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute.
And now a few final thoughts for this podcast. You've heard our discussion with Dr. Linda Brubaker of You've heard our discussion with Dr. Linda Brubaker from the Loyola University Medical Center in Maywood, Illinois, about pelvic floor disorders. I think we learned quite a few things. She explained what that means and the kinds of conditions that affect women, and they were, if you recall, most likely to be either loss of urine, leakage of urine, or what we call urinary incontinence, or leakage of or lack of control of our bowels, which we refer to as fecal incontinence, or pelvic prolapse, where we may see the reproductive organs extend down into the vagina and sometimes even protrude from the vagina. She's offered us some thoughts such as not to be embarrassed, not to hide it, and as she said, we have to break the sisterhood of silence, which means that if you or someone near and dear to you may be suffering from some of these symptoms, that there is help by going to your physician or your clinic or your health care provider and having them help approach this with the different therapies that we know about. She also brought us good hope by pointing out that as part of the Pelvic Floor Network, which is a group of research centers on pelvic floor disorders, that we're learning more about how to prevent, how to treat, and how to lessen the impact of pelvic floor disorders on the quality of life for women. And of course, it's not just women, but members of their family who also may have the quality of their lives affected by being part of that family and family community. I really liked the couple of sound bites she gave us, especially the one about sipping and not gulping. I'm not sure that's the exact language she used, but the essence is that just as we should, if we're looking at our diets and nutrition, not keep eating and eating heavily all day, that we take small bites and that helps us control our food intake, that perhaps in dealing with pelvic floor disorders and especially our urinary incontinence, that we should take small sips of water or of liquid, whatever liquid we're taking, instead of gulping, so that our bladders don't get that challenge. So she gave us lots more information, which I won't try to recap here, except What I'd like to end with is the excitement she brought in approaches to pelvic floor disorders and the fact that research is finally helping us to get some of the answers we need, and that research and medical care are now in a position to begin to help women who are suffering from these conditions that affect our quality of lives. So if you have any of the symptoms, or think you may have any of the symptoms of pelvic floor disorders, as she pointed out early on this podcast, it's important to diagnose them earlier because it may be easier to resolve those issues if caught earlier. And that brings me to the final line, that we, as we think about women's health and women's health research, it is important for us as women to make sure we take care of ourselves, that we get regular medical checkups, and that we take the medicines that we've been prescribed to take, such as for high blood pressure or diabetes, or that we watch our own behaviors and protect our health. And with that, brings to a close of this episode of Pinpoint on Women's Health. In just a moment, the announcer will tell you where to send your comments and your suggestions for future episodes. I'm Dr. Vivian Penn, Director of the Office of Research on Women's Health, here at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. Thank you for joining us.
You can email your comments and suggestions concerning this podcast to Marshall Love at lovem@od.nih.gov. Pinpoint on Women's Health comes from the Office of Research on Women's Health and is a production of the NIH Radio News Service, News Media Branch, Office of Communications and Public Liaison at the Office of the Director, National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.